Welcome to New Books in American Studies. I'm your host, Michael Amico. And today, our guest is Judith Giesberg, who has joined us to talk about her book, Sex and the Civil War, Soldiers, Pornography, and the Making of an American Morality, published by University of North Carolina Press. Judith Giesberg, an expert on the history of women and gender during the Civil War, is professor and director of graduate studies in the history department at Villanova University. She's also editor of the Journal of the Civil War Era. Two of her previous books include Civil War Sisterhood, the United States Sanitary Commission, and Women's Politics in Transition, which is about the understudied roles of women in relief efforts during the war, and Army at Home, Women and the Civil War on the Northern Home Front, which concerns the experiences of working-class women in the North. She's also the principal editor of Emily Davis's Civil War, The Diaries of a Free Black Woman in Philadelphia. Sex and the Civil War, a book whose main argument is that the Civil War is actually a turning point for the rise, the proliferation of anti-vice laws, laws against pornography, abortion, and eventually the rise of the purity movements at the end of the 19th century. It's quite an original argument, and so I'm excited to welcome Judith Giesberg to the show. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Great. So you mentioned at the beginning of the book, and as I was just saying in your bio, that you are or have been a scholar of gender and the war. And that's part of a sizable and ever-growing amount of thinking and scholarship about gender and war, particularly the Civil War. But not so much in this historiography about sex and sexuality and the war. But yet here we are with your book on sex and the Civil War. So why this topic as an entry point for you?
Right. Yes. So it's I sort of realized about halfway through this project that this is really the first time I was working on a book project where there really were no women in it at all, at least no real women. They were all women, fictional women, paper women, photographs of women. So it was, this was a departure. And for me, this project emerged from my study and my teaching in the history of women and gender. In particular, the questions that came to me that eventually became this book came to me when I was reading Helen Lefkowitz Horowitz's book on the as she calls it, sort of the 19th century sexual conversation that emerged about sex that she sort of traces it from the earlier 19th century. But by the mid 19th century, there were various voices in what she calls as the first sort of national conversation about sex and sexuality that came about when sex reformers wanted to rethink marriage and sex, and you sort of had this growing interest in reforming marriage, and you certainly had this sort of utopian reformers who wanted to rethink all of society and put those most intimate relationships in the middle of it. So this book was what I was reading in one of my classes and teaching one of my classes. And I discovered that, and of course I knew Anthony Comstock would be part of this, this book and this study, Helen Lefkowitz Horowitz book, but
Tell listeners quickly who Anthony Comstock is.
Oh, yes, of course. So Anthony Comstock is the person who would run this post-war. He was the center of this post-war morality campaign, was part of the lobbying effort to pass a series of state laws and a federal law, which was named the Comstock Law, which outlawed the mailing of pornography and other erotic materials through the United States mail. And the Comstock Law became the main piece of legislation used by these late 19th century morality campaigners to outlaw many different things, including information about birth control, and Comstock laws ultimately outlawed abortion and stayed in place really until the remnants of these Comstock laws were removed with in the 20th century with decisions like Roe versus Wade. So the Comstock law, so Comstock was, you know, the sort of central figure in this morality campaign. And of course, you know, studying the 19th century, I knew a lot about him. But what I didn't know was that he he fought in the Civil War, which was news to me. And so when I was reading this book, I realized that there was maybe something else there that I had missed about the connections between this post-war morality campaign and the United States Civil War. And I learned that from the
Go ahead. Is it called Rereading Sex? I think.
Yes, it's called Rereading Sex.
Right. Yep. So she obviously mentions and talks about Comstock because he's crucial in the later 19th century, but she's writing, tracing this history from the beginning to mid 19th century. And as you say, mentions that Comstock was in the Civil War and just sort of leaves it at that. And that grabbed your interest and to ask, okay, what is the place of that past for Comstock personally?
Yes. And what, if anything, does the war, you know, where does the war fit into this longer history that she traces in that book? And I think the book was published in 2002, in case listeners are interested in looking at that, Rereading Sex. So, yeah, so that was the origin of this book. And that's how I wound up, you know, studying this period and finding out more about what where the war fits into this longer history and what, if anything, the war had to do with those laws that were passed afterward.
Right. And so we're going to get to that because that's your sort of main argument. But it is curious that obviously, and you talk a little bit about this too, that, well, the assumption is that men are sexual beings and that they're going to express themselves sexually in some way during the war, not least of all because they're away from the kind of usual domestic lives that they may or may not have led. And there's always been, I'm assuming, an assumption that sex is a question among soldiers at war. But still little that's been written about it, that in terms of, the actual imaginations and behaviors of soldiers. Although there is one book, and you mention it, as well early on, Thomas Lowry's 1994 book, The Story the Soldiers Wouldn't Tell, The Sex in the Civil War, which you sort of say is interesting for the kind of primary source documents that he has found and uses, but also is driven by a kind of prurient interest, almost like a form of very mild pornography, you know, ooh, let's read what did happen. So can you talk about the place of that in the development of your project as well?
Yes, sure. Yeah. So Lowry's book is really designed for people who read for pleasure, read the Civil War, publications, or read books for pleasure on the Civil War. And the book itself does not ever claim to take this material and want to find out what it can tell us about the culture and the sexual lives of these men. It's really more about, and he even plays with this, I think, quite openly, not only with the title, but just throughout the collection with, you know, that this is really about, you know, seeing in the Civil War people something that reminds us of ourselves, which is really not the intention of what I'm trying to do, which is to find out really what sense, and, you know, what was their sexual life and their imaginations, what ways did they experience this central part of their identity, in a circumstance that was very different from what they were used to. So what, you know, that sort of that question about what it meant to be, you know, these men in these camps, and how is it that they experienced these materials that were now widely available to them. So I then started, and there is a good bit of literature on the mid 19th century and the emergence of pornography as a way to label this erotic material that scholars have studied this in the European context quite extensively. But for some reason, the American Civil War, you know, it just seemed as if it was going to be immune to this. And we just didn't want to imagine that this was part of the experience of men in this context, which seems silly to even.
Well, it seems yep. silly, but also it's almost a product of the history you're tracing. I mean, you talk about how the rise of these laws at the end of 19th century that essentially quiet the discussion, or at least
they do.
The discussion, they do. Are informing how we then talk or not talk about sex and the Civil War today. And that's a really interesting theme to trace. And again, we'll touch on that. So basically you're looking at a little bit of what Lowry has discovered, but trying to place it in a larger framework of meaning of how we might understand socialization at the time or
right.
gender roles.
Right.
And you're doing that through by looking at the rise and circulation of pornography. So talk a little bit about how you first began then to trace how pornography began to be solicited and circulated during wartime
sure.
among men.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a really interesting moment in the history of this country and sort of the larger world in which this stuff is circulated, because there's mid 19th century efforts in both France and France and the United Kingdom to rethink begin. There were some concerns about the stuff that emerged, and there were new laws that were passed in Great Britain, and there were court cases argued in France in the mid 19th century, and the results were that in every case, they tried to control the stuff through customs laws and trying to sort of stop the stuff from coming in or find out how they can sort of staunch the flow of this stuff. And that particularly happens here in the United States. There's an early effort to sort of stop the stuff from coming in that snuck into a law about customs, and similar things are happening in the UK and in France as well. And then, of course, so what happens then is there's a domestic production that rushes in to fill the void. Now that the stuff is more costly and more difficult to import it, local manufacturers
make it ourselves. Right.
They make it themselves, and there's of course no copyright protection of any of this stuff. So what they're usually doing is simply literally copying it from these other contexts and just changing words here and there.
Right.
And there's really not even an effort to disguise the fact that it's just being plagiarized. Wholly, adopted from wherever they originally found it, and then it's just being produced en masse and cheaply in New York in particular, but in other urban places as well. And that's happening, in just the last few years before the Civil War begins. And then there are some local efforts to control. To use this law to control its circulation, as these local manufacturers discover that it can be difficult to circulate the stuff locally, they take to the mails, because that way they can avoid prosecution, avoid detection by simply mailing the stuff. And then when the Civil War happens, of course, mail gets more and more efficient in the North and cheaper. So these manufacturers are well positioned to use this moment to its fullest and begin to circulate the stuff widely. The moment that the war begins, they see this as an opportunity, and the stuff becomes widely available. And people mention that from all over the place, from both the Eastern Theater and the Western Theater. The stuff is obviously reaching the men. And some officers complain about it. There's some letters that appear from soldiers in the newspapers, but there's not a whole lot of there's not a concerted effort to control this stuff really, or a really serious effort to control this stuff until the beginning of early in 1865. Congressmen pass a measure that outlaws the circulation of the stuff through the U.S. mail. This measure past sort of, you know, very at the very end of the war, doesn't get a whole lot of attention. It doesn't seem to really do anything at all. Very few people are even charged, and those people who are charged seem to have slipped past any. They are not convicted. But that sets the foundation for what will be the Comstock laws, right, in their aftermath. Yep.
So two points I want to stress in what you say, and one of them I think is quite interesting for people who hadn't thought about the development of pornography. They may be very familiar with pornography itself, which is to say that your discussion of pornography really is premised on the idea that pornography is an invention, or the idea of pornography is an invention, that it's,
right,
it's a way of talking about certain material that is born out of regulating that material.
Right.
The meaning of images, whether they're dangerous or not dangerous, is something that is not stable over time. And that's one. So that this is something that's coming out of the need to regulate and police. And then in that conversation is about, well, what's acceptable and what's not. And then two is that this is not the whole country who's up in arms about this. That there are this is mostly a set of very men who are in political positions, and maybe forming these laws for all sorts of reasons, but they're not necessarily, if at all, representative of like a cultural, like a moral system, you know, where sometimes think about, well, those laws were so strong in the 19th century, you know, people must not have accepted pornography like we do today, which is completely wrong. It's really that there were loud voices in
there really were
positions.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering if you could just speak a little bit about how that this idea of pornography is really shaped by Comstock hugely, and we can talk about him for sure. But even that, not that many men in positions of power.
Right. It is a very uniquely American story in that sense, as I say in the book, because in both Great Britain and in France, there are some very big court cases that get a lot of people talking about images and words and how they shape actions or how they can influence actions. And the same in Great Britain. There's much more conversation about it. In the United States, there isn't, as you say, a groundswell of concern about pornography during the war, and certainly not after the war. There really isn't. It becomes the concern of a small group of men after the war who are seeking, you know, opportunities to either hold on to influence or to expand the influence that they have on American culture. And they ride the wave of what is the sort of morally invigorated state, a state that emerges from the Civil War with the sense that, you know, that they are in the moral right. And certainly emancipation is one of those ways in which they sort of see, you know, the state sort of emerges, that the United States emerges from the war morally invigorated, and of course victory helps as well, all of that. Reformers see this as an opportunity to correct other moral wrongs as well. And in this case, they target erotica, but pornography. But as you said as well, the term pornography is actually something that doesn't even come into usage until people who are producing this stuff and selling this stuff wind up in the courtroom. It's really something. The term is a product of that moment that certain people have access to this stuff, and others question whether or not they should have access to it. And part of that is class. certainly the sort of democratization of access to this material that raises you know, eyebrows among among an elite who, right, they would see whatever, or they are certainly very clear in their minds that any materials that they own would not, you know, does not count as pornography, but pornography is a problem that needs to be dealt with. So even sort of the emergence of the term, and in the mid to late 19th century, it becomes more, it's being used, signals to us that this is a struggle that has less to do with the actual materials and more to do with sort of a status and other sorts of social questions that have emerged, that emerged in the 19th century. And some of those are about class. Some of those are about gender. I think they're also about race. And so this is the moment that this study, tries to begin to explore. What does it mean that we begin to use terms like pornography? What does it mean that this small group identifies it as a problem that can be solved?
Right, and a problem for other people, not them.
So not them.
You say a few
right.
times, which is really great, you know, that there's like a gentleman pornography, which is not pornography.
Right.
So any quote-unquote obscene material that upper class or people in power or with influence are connected have, that's not objectionable obscene material.
No,
but it becomes obscene once it's in the hands of people who are problems in other ways, or are conceptualized as problems in other ways.
Yes.
And obviously during the war, then you have a mixing of classes, and you have sorts of men together who would maybe not have normally been together, at the same time as the need for discipline and regulation and, you know, following rules. So what were some of the problems that were imagined pornography causing among these men at war?
So the problem when it shows up in military records, it's associated with in the minds of those people who sort of record it and describe this or name this as a problem, as a problem in men's, you know, in this sort of when they're not actively campaigning, right? Right, exactly. So during the winter months or other times when there's, you know, the discipline of regular campaigning seems to solve a lot of problems. It solves the problem of drinking. It solves the problem of general indiscipline. And certainly pornography is another one of those, you know, that you could sort of put in that bucket of things that that the army has to deal with when men are not actively campaigning. So it's not surprising that we don't see a lot of, in court martial records, for instance, we don't see a lot of men, being court martialed for holding and having this pornography. We actually don't see a lot of it. When men do, and the same can be said about regimental order books, which is another level of discipline that you can find, you know, where you can find mentions of what they're getting in trouble for. So we don't see a lot of it when it does show up, or when we do hear of men who have erotic materials or circulating erotic materials. They're also in trouble for other things. So they're bad soldiers because of other things they're doing. And in some cases, those are cases when they are, you know, in the case of one soldier who I talk about, and the one officer I talk about in the book, because he's sharing it was more of a question of his sharing it with men who are not are not officers. So he's married. It's an officer who's sharing the materials with enlisted men, and there's a, you know, there's sort of a sense that you know that in and of itself can lead to bigger problems and can encourage indiscipline. Right. But really, you know, really the erotic materials are invoked when in these disciplinary records when the soldier has other problems. There's other things about him that have raised concerns.
Right. So
and in general, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, so there's when someone upsets the power dynamic, And
yes,
that can be for good or bad reasons. I mean, obviously,
right.
Like it may not be a problem that someone does that, or it may be a problem and that it does signal
right.
some other larger question of behavior that shouldn't be reduced
yes.
to sex and pornography. But it can go either way.
Right. Absolutely. Right. Right. Yeah. So the other, and you know, of course, that we know, of course, that other men are circulating the stuff and are reading the stuff. And they seem to have never gotten into trouble at all. So,
yes.
so they seem to have been able to balance, what was demanded of them as, you know, as far as being good, as good soldiers and yet still being able to consume the stuff and circulate the stuff and not run into any trouble. And there seems to have been, and even when we find records of the stuff in court martial records, when somebody has, you know, violated some other expectation, it's very interesting to see how widely the erotic materials are shared and how much knowledge these men, different ranks, different classes, different parts of the country actually know of this stuff and seem to, you know, not be concerned on some level at all about it. Again, as long as it doesn't upset any other sort of expectation that one would have of a soldier yet. Right. Yet. Go ahead.
And you also say that the circulation, even among different ranks or classes of men, encourages a kind of camaraderie or
it does,
or even forms the camaraderie sort of that it actually almost aids cohesion among the men, which is helpful
right.
in so many ways
right.
while fighting a war.
Right. Yeah, I think it does. I mean, there's certainly lots of evidence to suggest that, you know, that these images and these words could bring men together in a way that that one would imagine, you know, would be helpful to creating cohesion among soldiers of different ranks coming from different places in the country.
And
they share that culture and they share some of the language. I mean, they know the words to describe this stuff. They know the words to songs and they know what the images are. So they obviously know it. They're obviously sharing it. It's not a problem. Right.
And this seems to be a perfect moment to bring in Anthony Comstock because, one of the surprising things you say is that, yes, he served in the war, but he didn't actually fight in the war. In that when he joined the 17th Connecticut Regiment,
mm-hmm.
They were stationed in St. Augustine, Florida, which was at that time a kind of convalescing camp.
Mm-hmm.
For officers and other Union regiments, and one of the things you talk about is that Comstock's disgust towards pornography and obscene talk and songs is very much at play among the soldiers who are doing nothing but having fun together and fraternizing
right.
in a way that may have made him feel left out. I was imagining as I was reading your quotes from him about that time, how much how jealous he may have been of a camaraderie that he was not made a part of, and that was his sort of targeting this material a way of managing his anxiety of not feeling accepted among these other men.
Oh yeah, I think so. Yeah, and it certainly didn't help that his brother his brother died at Gettysburg from his injuries at Gettysburg, and he joins the regiment to replace his brother, and he never fit in like his brother did, and that certainly made that that feeling that you described so nicely just now made it just exaggerated it or made it even worse, because his brother had made the ultimate sacrifice. He had joined the regiment early, he had really become part of the regiment. And then when he died, his brother came along and his brother never filled his shoes, and his brother never really had, Anthony Comstock never really had the opportunity to try. But he also didn't seem to try very hard. From what we have left, he didn't seem to try very hard to fit in either. He seemed to, enjoy, on some level, he seemed to enjoy sort of being on the outside. But then I think he also clearly he clearly resented it, and he never seemed to have gotten over it. He didn't go to their reunions. He didn't, you know, ever make any attempt to be part of that regiment in its aftermath.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to laugh at it. It's just that the emotional narrative is sort of very clear.
Yeah, know? It is. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't know how it's just it's very much on the surface. How many primary sources in Comstock's voice do we have? I mean, are there letters that are from that time, or is it mainly biography or autobiography that's written much later at that time?
Well, this was one of the frustrating things about this project is there's not a lot left on Comstock. For somebody who really prided himself in being such this public crusader, there's hardly anything left to document his private life at all. There is a diary that that big pieces of it were reproduced in an early biography of him, but the original diary has vanished. I haven't been able to find it, and other people who studied him haven't been able to find it. And the same can be said about any correspondence. Wherever it is, it has escaped the escaped the recognition of archivists and others whom I've corresponded with, and other people, like I said, who studied this period have not been able to find it. There are these authorized biographies, people who he worked with to write his biographies. Those are extant, and of course his own writings about his work among trying to rescue young men from themselves and their imaginations. That stuff is there. And of course, arrest files, those kinds of things are all there. But the private Comstock remains elusive in many ways.
Which, as you say, is interesting for the very fact that he's obsessed with other people's private lives. And
yes.
And so yes. Maybe there is a reason for the destruction of his own. It almost seems like he was trying to build a public self that was synonymous with his private self. And I don't want to hold up private and public as two separate domains, but it very much his sort of the language of his selfhood becomes a kind of legal language, is almost adjudicated through the very terms that he helps shape and further after the war.
Right.
And I was imagining him transitioning from his sort of lack of fraternity during the war and then to his post-war life. It was almost as if he was then trying to create a fraternity of moral crusaders. You know, and that would be his acceptance finally. And it was a group of people that wasn't, again, as we sort of talked about when we started, not that large. I mean, not everyone is overly concerned with this issue. There obviously there's enough that he found friends and that he was able to really craft the language of, his own community. At the same time, it was a language that impugned other communities.
Yes.
And I know he becomes, this sort of sounds, I mean, this just sounds so contrived as I'm describing it. And this is probably one of the reasons why he becomes kind of a laughing stock.
He does.
Of people in the country and then abroad too. So, can you just touch a little bit about on that?
Sure.
On how he was kind of caricatured as almost a joke.
Yes.
Even though super powerful, we don't want to forget. And again, we'll come back to that about how many waves this has left that still churn
the legacy
through our culture today.
Yeah.
But a lot of people saw him and could see through him as a joke.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, he became he became the brunt of jokes both here and even in the British context. The punchline of jokes was Anthony Comstock. So he becomes this caricature of a moral crusader. Even as the laws are very much in place, and there wasn't this large public conversation about the Comstock Law, and you can search in vain for media coverage of it. It just doesn't get any airtime But the Comstock Law, you know, passes Congress and is signed by President Grant. It becomes federal law. And it follows, and is followed by state measures that, that are passed that do the same thing. Yet again, you know, there's not it's not like Comstock was at the center of a large crusade, a large campaign. He joins a group of reformers who are affiliated with the New York the YMCA,
right.
And these men are very, very conscious of their class status, and they're very concerned about the loss of that status. That they believe, you know, they believe that they have to be vigilant about sort of maintaining influence that could, you know, that can be taken from them at any time, you know, by the growth of, you know, by a larger immigrant population that comes into the city of New York, but also just the sort of, you know, as men no longer sort of search for those kinds of role models and search elsewhere for role models, what will be their role in the post-war era? Many, and these men, of course, don't serve in the war. They find ways to avoid that service. Go ahead.
Yes. You say those kinds of role models. Do you mean Christian role models?
Yeah, these elite Christian self-identified.
Yes. Yeah, the YMCA's Young Men's Christian Association that today may not carry that as explicitly, even though it's in the name,
right.
but its formation is embedded in a deep religiosity.
Yes, absolutely. And they're sort of and they're concerned about what will happen, you know, as the kind of influence that they believe their status should give them. They don't wield that kind of influence anymore over young men and over society at large. So they're concerned about this. They're concerned, and this is a very small group of people in New York who begin to, you know, raise this as a concern. By the mid 19th century, they're sort of, you know, churning out these, self-help kinds of books for young men coming into New York to sort of, you know, to beware of confidence men and to sort of, you know, watch out for people who you don't want to influence you and you don't want to don't want to make into your role models and be careful of all these dangers that the city has. And so that stuff is predates the war. And then during the war, these men will become the leaders of the United States Christian Commission, which takes this mission that they believe is evolving in New York and other urban areas and takes it to the men in the form of sending out good literature to men serving in the war and passing out Bibles and other things during the war. And then in the aftermath of the war, this United States Christian Commission, the leaders of that organization get involved with the Young Men's Christian Association or the YMCA, which is the center really that they form the foundation for the lobbying that will become the Comstock Law.
Okay. So as you've said a few times now that, the discussion around the anti-pornography stuff specifically is not that great. And that it's by a small group of powerful, but a small group of people, men. So just to review, basically, we see kind of an increased circulation of pornography during the war because of technologies and also ready audience of men and people see this as tied to potential disobedience among the ranks, which can be true and can be not true.
Right.
And then we have Comstock, who has dealing with his own personal social anxiety or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are all coming together for him in pursuing post-war anti-pornography, anti-vice laws. Now, you also then talk about how these and these become these kind of explode or associate themselves with birth control laws, and laws about against prostitution and and abortions. So larger social issues that do, you know, continue again to reverberate today. So how did that happen that this nobody cares about porn really, this passing of this law becomes attached to other laws, and it all happens after the Civil War, and we'll talk about how you think, and I think this is right, is all one with a response to the question of, well, what is a union now, and how marriage plays into that, but how at first does the question of abortion and contraception and then also prostitution come into this?
These, at the state level, these state level Comstock laws become in many cases they riders are added on to these laws that originate as a conversation about sort of controlling and keeping the male pure of this stuff and you know, emerge from this concern about how we can keep this stuff, you know, again, not a big concern, but a concern that enough congressmen bring back to their local constituencies, and these laws are passed at the local level. And at the local level too, there's these riders are added on by physicians and who during the Civil War, the medical profession becomes the medicine becomes professionalized, and doctors emerge from the war with a sense of themselves as being part of a profession. Their first sort of, you know, medical journals and whatnot begin to, you know, sort of represent that level of professionalism, and part of that is, and part of their efforts to sort of secure the profession and define the profession, is translated into sort of defining what, you know, who doesn't get to practice medicine, or whose medicine is not considered, you know, a real medicine or professional medicine. And these doctors who come back from the war are concerned about these things and are interested in these things, and they are also politically connected. And these local Comstock laws also, you know, to the list of banned materials are added publications about advising women about controlling their fertility. So publications that might talk to women about birth control, for instance, are added to the list of banned materials. So too are advertisements for abortion services. Those are all added at the local level, and then of course at the federal level, they get added on to the Comstock law.
But not because they're a threat to men's self understanding as the anti-pornography stuff was, but because explain to me the other reason. I mean, you're saying,
oh sure, yeah,
the professionalization of the doctors and wanting to control their profession seems to be very different than, you know, the sort of Comstock anti-vice stuff. Yet, both are connected through some kind of association that it's all obscene material.
It is, yes. Yeah. So the doctors, you know, and they're sort of wanting to drive out irregular medical practitioners, want to control. Want to label stuff that is not produced by medical professionals as obscene, and also to drive out those who perform or who can provide these medical practices. So that stuff gets labeled obscene. But it also helps that at the time there are a lot of conversations happening at the end of the Civil War about marriage. This is kind of where we can invoke what we already think about when we study this period, about the sort of backlash that people worry about what happens, you know, that what sorts of intimate relations get upset when the country is at war. And there are a lot of different conversations swirling around both at the federal level and at the state level about, you know, what has happened in the war, and has marriage been affected? So people, conduct studies about whether or not we're really experiencing a rise in divorce, right? Or what should count as marriage?
Right after the war?
After the war, yeah. And there are a lot of different, and there are articles and editorials written about that. Like, are we entering a period in which marriage is, you know, is under stress, and what will happen to marriage? And that you can see that stuff even reflected in congressional conversations about freed people, right? You know, what's going to count as marriage for them, and how can we police that? How do we legislate marriage, and how do we you know, how do we protect it if it's threatened, and how do we define it legislatively as marriage? So all of that stuff gets considered as part of these conversations as well. So one might not approach a conversation about or a concern about birth control or abortion from the perspective of medical practitioners, right? But once it's allied with, or once somebody connects it to a concern about marriage, then it has a larger, you know, the consequences of it seem bigger, right? And the need to control the stuff seems legitimate. So some of this, these writers get added on maybe in the beginning because they're introduced by medical professionals, but then they become part of this larger conversation about how we can protect marriage.
Right. And so again, it's about those in power holding on to their power and worried that,
yeah,
that either, you know, the women will speak too loudly and take it away, or now free black people will speak too loudly,
right,
and take up too much space and take it away.
Or not marry in the way that, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Or lower class people or men you just don't like for a number of personal reasons. And so marriage, the idea of marriage becomes a way to kind of bring all these issues together in terms of, you know, obviously, there's been a lot of work about slave marriages and how,
yes,
did or did not translate after the war when slaves were free. And so were there marriages that they already had legitimate and
right,
move into that realm? And you mentioned, as well as other scholars, that it was they were very much forced into a kind of marriage, a legal framework that speaks more to the sort of control of what marriage is or should be than it,
right,
speaks to one's free choice to enter into that marriage.
Right. It does. Yeah. And there's really great work by a scholar named Frank. Her last name is Frank or Frankie. Right. I can't remember how.
Catherine
Frank, who talks about that sort of, you know, whether or not it makes sense to think about it, the freedom to marriage, to marry, or whether or not it's this, you know, imposition of marriage, you know, that marriage becomes sort of a federally mandated and federally defined thing. Or at the state level. I think that this conversation about erotic materials and what if anything these erotic materials potentially disrupt or potentially threaten gets very much wrapped up in these conversations about marriage.
Right. Yeah. And that marriage very much stands in for a discussion about the future structure of the country.
Yes.
Especially because, well, explicitly because the question of a union and what that means was very much at stake during the war.
So it
could easily have become, and I think it was in many ways, conflated with the question of marriage, which is really the question of proper relationships between people and what was public,
right,
and what was private, and what could potentially upset the power dynamics within those many times unequal relationships. So obviously now we're seeing that sex and sexuality is a huge question of this moment,
right,
during the war and after the war. And you also, but it also allows us to sort of look back at pre-war and think about the sexualization of slavery and how desire functioned there. And I bring this up because you talk about a little bit in terms of the, how sometimes anti-slavery tracks, material that was written to show the sort of barbarism of slavery could be seen as obscene. Because it was depicting a slave masters and mistresses, women and men, beating their slaves in ostensibly a quite enjoyable way for the person in power.
Right.
And so there was a worry about the obscenity of that material. So if you could speak a little bit about that, but also it just sort of opens up on this larger question of how much the sort of desire is at play in mm-hmm. all of these sites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think abolitionists walked a fine line, as did a lot of other mid-century, you know, humanitarian reformers, between condemning what they saw as sort of this, this Southern culture and Southern slaveholders as being enslaved to their emotions and to their passions, right? And locating a problem with sort of controlling those passions and saying that was a particularly Southern problem in their condemnation of slavery and Southern culture, and also tapping a very real interest in that kind of in those sorts of vivid descriptions and certainly an erotic imagination that was shared among readers in the North that they could condemn an erotic South at the same time as they could embed in their critique of slavery some of the elements of, you know, that eroticization, or the way that they sort of describe violence as erotic. They could embed in that some of those same elements. And they talk about that. I think they are very aware that they're sort of treading a line there very carefully about sort of, you know, reproducing the very thing that they are condemning about their subject matter. But they also use it very quite effectively. I think there's, you know, those people like James Henry Hammond who marshal a spirited defense against abolitionist critique put their finger right on it when they say, you know, when they talk about that, you know, that this stuff has an audience in mind when they describe the violence of slavery. They're doing it in such a way because they know it's going to titillate Northern readers, and they know those readers are women, and they know they want to read this stuff, and they know their audience.
Right.
And reformers know that too, I think.
And then it does have an emotional impact, and when something hits you at a sort of not purely intellectual level, then it may be more powerful. And so whatever other messages or calls for action that it was after might be more effective for that. So you're right. It's a thin line, but it's a necessary one.
It is. Yep. Yes, it is.
But again, it's, you know, all these different sites of desire and sexualization. We know they're there, but we all kind of just can sense things around us, and when we look around and at what we see. But the stakes are, it sounds to me, in how we talk about it, and who invents or has the language that sort of can shape it as a problem or as not a problem, or allow us to see something or not see something. And and I feel like so many readers who don't study this themselves, again, might just take the loudest people in the room as the truth, you know, it's simply more that they had access to languages such as the law that are more easily disseminated and more easily recorded,
right?
Where there's so many other conversations going on that we don't have records for, but that are actually more representative of how sex is working positively and negatively in many instances.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Yep. I think you stated it very well. Yeah, I think there's a way in which, you know, we've sort of given Comstock, we've sort of allowed Comstock to win this when we haven't brought all of those other voices. We haven't given all those other voices the time and the attention they need. And even the Women's Christian Temperance Union, right, which begins at the, which in some ways is parallel to Comstock in some of their concerns. And it is a massive organization that really engages many women in its reform campaign. They haven't even really been introduced into this history effectively because they were, I mean, Comstock always claims that he's worried about the young, right? That he's going to protect the young from themselves, like the youth, are going to be, he wants to protect them, even though he's nothing he ever does. He actually never connects any of those dots. He assumes that when young men read erotic material, they become, they become violent or whatever. And he tries to arrest all of these people that he thinks produce the stuff. But he never connects the dots, and his campaign is never really focused on young people. And it never effectively controls the flow of pornography either. But the Women's Christian Temperance Union actually really was interested in children and women's lives. And the Women's Christian Temperance Union endorses these Comstock measures because for what they think they're going to do to protect families, right. But they don't go with Comstock down that road of translating this stuff into a condemnation of prostitutes, even though certainly the Women's Christian Temperance Union want to convert prostitutes. They want to, they want to eliminate prostitution. Right, they see these women as,
yeah.
No, they don't. They see them as victims. And they're not endorsing Comstock going after abortionists or these other people because they see that all as part of the package. So they're a really loud voice too, but they still don't get as much airtime as does Comstock in this conversation. We see them as these women who are closing down saloons and things like that, but they really are part of this conversation that we need to know more about, as are all the other people who the Comstock laws will be used against, throughout the 100 years that they're in place.
Yeah, they're throughout the 20th century.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And still, I would argue still today, I think we still haven't gotten over our hangover about what sort of relationship does the American state have with sort of regulating citizens' morality? I think, we're still dealing with that.
And you, speaking of that, and we'll wrap up you end the book talking about homosexuality and how specifically YMCAs become hotbeds of homosexual activity at community formation.
Right.
I mean that in a very positive, rich, robust sense. But I have to share you a tidbit now from my own research because it directly appears at this point in the story, which is that Comstock's biographer is Charles Trumbull. And
yes.
Charles Trumbull's father was Henry Clay Trumbull, who served as a chaplain in the Civil War. And I have been writing about his intimate same-sex relationship with another man in his Connecticut regiment. And
oh, fantastic.
It is a story that hasn't been recorded in the same way that Comstock's has, because it's not translatable to legal language of the time. But here's the kicker. So Comstock shows up when he joins the 17th Connecticut Regiment at St. Augustine, Florida, as we mentioned at the beginning of the interview. The 10th Connecticut Regiment, Henry Trumbull Regiment, is in St. Augustine. And Henry Trumbull is in charge of all the churches in the town. And who does he literally hand the keys of the church over to but Anthony Comstock? So this man, who at that time was in love with another man of his regiment, hands over the keys to the church to a man who obviously struggled with his own intimacies with other men in any number of ways. And then Trumbull's son comes to write Comstock's biography. And so, there's history doesn't take any straight road or any narrative.
It really doesn't.
Things come and go, and not always do they get better. And maybe they were better before.
No, they don't. They really don't. And that is, that's a really important discovery that you've made in it. And I've never accepted that Comstock was as alone as he made himself out to be. I think there's much more to be. We have much more to discover about him, though he saw himself as so terribly alone. There's still more to be learned. So I can't wait. I can't wait to read your book.
There's an image there that he wants to show of himself as alone.
Right.
Okay. Well, we should end here. Judith Giesberg has been our guest for this fascinating conversation about her book, Sex and the Civil War, Soldiers, Pornography, and the Making of an American Morality, out from University of North Carolina Press. Judith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.